It's HPR, All Things Considered, and I'm Dave Lawrence. We're celebrating a unique bit of news that we've covered recently on the program. The international mission to breed Harapan, the adorable Sumatran rhinoceros, who is from the Cincinnati Zoo, and in an act of global collaboration that we'll learn more about, he recently moved from Cincinnati to the Sumatran Rhino Sanctuary in Indonesia. And today we have another very special guest related to that, and it is a huge privilege to get to talk to this guy. Short of speaking with Harapan himself, we have the guy on the line, Paul Reinhart. And Paul has been widely reported on as Harapan's keeper, but his role at the Cincinnati Zoo, obviously much broader than that. He's been a zookeeper there, according to online information about him, at the Cincinnati Zoo since 1981, 34 years. He is also the team leader of Wildlife Canyon there. He accompanied this adorable animal, not just on his historic trip, but for years of love and care at the zoo. And we're really privileged to get to welcome Paul to All Things Considered. Thank you very much, Paul, for taking some time. It's an honor.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And how far back do you go with rhinoceros in general?
I started working with black rhino at the African Veldt when I first started. Actually, even as a student, I was lucky enough to hang around the area, and then we worked with black rhino there. Ralph and Princess were the first two I started working with, a breeding pair of black rhino, and then the zoo acquired Indian rhino, an adorable male named Jimmy that lived down there at Develt, and then worked with all the Sumatran rhino from the time they came to the zoo in 1989.
And what's that name, Develt? What was the Africa? Is that at the zoo or is that a different place?
No, that's at the zoo. It's the department, African Veldt.
Oh, get it.
V-E-L-D-T. It's just the name of the department. I'm not affiliated with that department anymore. I'm mostly focused down at Wildlife Canyon. But it was all one department when I first started there.
Amazing. What a long time you've been there, and a lot of different rhinos. And Wildlife Canyon, who is there that you oversee on a regular basis right now?
Right now we have camels, a couple of emu, pea horse, which most people don't know what they are. They're called Przewalski horse or Asian wild horses. Takin, which is spelled T-A-K-I-N. They're a Chinese goat antelope type thing. not real widely seen in zoos, but very, very cool animals. They're big and strong and pretty unique looking. They're from China. We have warty pigs and capybara. Capybara are a new addition to Wildlife Canyon. They're the largest rodent of the rodents in the world.
I know the capybara. And where are the rhinos?
Over there in the Veldt, there's a pair of black rhino and one female Indian rhino still located in the middle of the zoo. What used to be known as the African Veldt is kind of the hoof stock. There's bongo and okapi and rhino and zebra in that exhibit.
And you don't work with those rhinos?
Correct. Oh. I'm rhino-less right now.
Oh, man. And so your Sumatran rhino experience began with whom and when exactly?
Began when Mahatu, the first Sumatran rhino, arrived at the zoo in on June 5th, 1989.
Okay. And then, aside from their rarity, smaller size, and hairy nature, what makes the Sumatran rhino, Paul, unique or different from other rhinos?
Well, they're a very vocal species of rhino. They have a wide range of squeaks and peeps and whistles and blowing that they do to communicate with one another and communicate in the forest. And they did a lot of communication in our building when there was more than one rhino there.
Amazing. Okay. So that's something. About their personality, too, anything that makes them different? I mean, I would phrase it by saying, when you think of, when I used to think of rhinoceros as just a person who didn't know any better, I thought of them as this ferocious, fierce animal. And then I was captivated by Andalas, I guess, when that story broke, and then the hairpan thing after that, and you start looking at him and he looks so sweet and gentle and innocent, you just want to give him a big kiss right on his face. So about their personality, what can you share to as a follow-up to what I just said?
They are very unique. Personally, I think they're very people-oriented. Once they get used to people, and the calves that we had born in Cincinnati were raised around people all their lives. So a Sumatran rhino will come when you call them. They enjoy being hand-fed, apples and bananas and carrots and things. They'll stand there and eat from your hand all day if you let them. Something else, in the wild, a Sumatran rhino can hear very well, and they can hear people or other animals in the forest. And they're going to be long gone before a person ever knew that they were that there was a rhino even close. But when animals are brought into captivity, they seem to calm down almost immediately, and they seem to like that people-rhino connection. Maybe it's just because they know they get food from that guy or girl, but they seem to like to be around people. They don't like being locked out on their exhibit. They like having the choice, being accessed in and out. And we spoiled all the Sumatran rhino that we had there. They're very docile, certainly not ferocious, like you said.
Right.
Absolutely almost lovable.
Right. That's the impression that I got. I mean, it's a real education. And just through the activity of those two of Emmy's children, I guess you could say, making all the news, they've kind of spread the truth about what they are, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
Who have you been closest to emotionally?
It's hard to pick one out, just like your children. You don't want to say you love one more than the other. Everybody was very fond of Emmy. She was... she was a star here in Cincinnati. The fact that she would do almost anything you asked of her, they learned volumes about their breeding cycle, and through doing ultrasound, Dr. Roth was able to unlock all the secrets behind breeding them. We would take blood from her, and she was always voluntary. She would voluntarily come into the chute. Even if she didn't like it, she would bang her feet or make it known she wasn't happy, but she never refused to come into the chute or to give blood. When we took blood, it was always out of the ear, so she had the choice of throwing her head or misbehaving, but she never did that. She was just a star here.
Yeah, she seems it from everything I've read online. It's touching. I take it from what I talked to Dr. Stoops, so I know a little bit about some of what you do. And you go into the enclosures with these rhinos, correct? You're with no barrier between you and them.
I did, yes. Not everybody did. One thing I like to do, the reason I'm so loved what I do is because there's usually not a whole lot of barrier between myself and the animals, with whether it's camels or red pandas. I like that intimate connection that I sometimes get. And Sumatran rhino are honestly very docile. They're big. They're 1,800 pounds, and you have to be careful if he were to get spooked or frightened and he turns the wrong way, he could knock you down and step on you. But and as he matured, I noticed also he tended to start, once we were done feeding him, he would start to push on me a little bit as if I were another rhino. As he matured, I'm sure part of that learning process is pushing on other rhinos or on trees, and that made me a little bit nervous, but he was always very, very good. And on occasion, I'd take other people in to get just the right photograph, and he was always very willing to do that.
You're talking about Hairpin?
Yes, yes. But I went in with everybody, except for Ipu, all those calves' father. All those calves' father was Ipu, and he was very much a wild rhino. He was wild caught. When he was an adult, an absolute fantastic animal, if there ever was a fantastic rhino. He was never a tame sort of animal. He would always let you know that he was boss in his exhibit, and he was absolutely indescribable rhino character.
Your life is cool, man. I just dig talking to you. I can't even, even in the middle of the thing, I just got to thank you because it really means a lot. These animals are so special. When you look at a little rhinoceros, not when they're first born so much as a few weeks, a month or two later, whatever, man, are they cute. I mean, they're just a really, it's almost intimidating how adorable they are. You can't believe what a special animal. And you were there on that note of the births, because this is really one of the things that makes where you have been so key. Oop, you have to get that, or are you okay?
No, it's my wife's.
Okay.
But go ahead.
So you were there for
ruin it.
You're there for the birth of Andalas, Suchi, and Hairpin, correct? And then you went to Sumatra to where Hairpin is, and you were there for Andalas' son Andatu's birth.
Correct.
You saw all of this. So what's involved, Paul, with these births? And if you have any memories, stories relating to Hairpin's birth, and just paint a picture for folks of because this is a really serious thing, and you've been a firsthand part of it.
You know, I've seen other rhinos give birth. The neat thing is that Emmy and even Ratu over in Sumatra, there was no doubt about what was coming. They seemed to be very vocal. They were pacing and spraying urine, making it very apparent that something big was happening. So you got kind of used to looking for that. I always think back to Dr. Roth when we were watching, I think, Suchi being born and leading up to it. Emmy was carrying on, and she's squeaking and whistling and making this big ordeal about it. And Terry said, you know, I can't imagine these animals walking through the forest making a big deal about this, attracting all this attention. So why they do it, I don't know. Obviously, it's a big event. Having an 80-pound baby come out of you, but that's what always it's obvious that there's a baby coming, but you don't know why they're making. Most animals are very quiet about it. Hoofstock will go and lay down. They're pretty quiet about it. Camels will pace a little bit. I've seen camels born, and they moo. They make the occasional vocalization, but never the trumpeting and this big ordeal that Emmy did on all three, and Ratu also. She was outside, had about a half an acre paddock, and she's pushing down trees and just squeaking and squealing, and just seemed to make this huge ordeal out of it, and I'm not sure why.
You you describe it so well. One of the things, I guess, that it goes along with what you're saying, in the video of Hairpin's birth, Emmy's eyes are so wide in the video, and so are Hairpin's eyes. And is that also something you've noticed, or is that a part of the process?
I know what you're talking about, because Emmy's eyes got really big. Hang on just a sec.
That's some wild African dogs or something there?
yeah. Ohio wild dogs. the eyes on the Sumatran rhinos, I don't know what to tell you. I can't imagine that that's anything significant, but the eyes of the Sumatran rhino that we dealt with are very tender, or there's a lot that can go wrong with them. What we have to figure, what we have to work on here is the fact that these rhinos don't encounter the sun very much where they're from. They live in the very deep forest. They're always in shade, and so here we had to be very careful that they weren't out in the sun too much. Now, obviously, they weren't like that when they were giving birth or when they're being born, but their eyes reveal an awful lot about them when you're working with them.
He has the sweetest eyes. There are photos of that of Harrapin that are so endearing. He is one of the most gorgeous animals of any creature I've ever seen. He's so beautiful. And you, the thing that I've been very curious about, aside from the trip itself, was the training that went involved. I've heard a little bit about it, but what did you do to get him ready for this adventure? And if you can also paint a picture of the crate in terms of its dimensions.
Okay. I wish I probably have the dimensions. I always carry a notebook when I'm working, and if at some point during this I'll try to refer back to them. The crate is a steel frame with wooden oak planks that run the length of it and the floor. The neat thing about the crate is there's a window in the front, and it's almost kind of like a Dutch door, only up at the top. So you can open that, and you can hand feed him in that crate. You can put browse in. It's actually two doors, so it opens up a pretty good way. So his whole nose, or maybe a third of his head, can come out through that crate, and he seemed to like that. The crate was put into place at one of the doors, and that became part of his living space. Now, I often heard that he was, you know, at night he was locked in the crate, but that was absolutely not the case. He had access to the crate a lot, and we would bring him in every day, feed him in the crate, produce, browse, everything he normally gets. And while we were doing that, we would walk around the crate and talk to him and knock on the crate. In time, you started banging on a crate so it's nice and loud, so that when you close that door, it's not anything out of the ordinary. The noises that we made were noises that he was going to encounter. You know, you can't replicate the noise of an airport or riding on a truck, but you can desensitize animals to the noise when you're moving the crate. Oftentimes, you use a crane or you use a whole lot of people and you scoot the crate along the floor, or you use a forklift to pull it to the door, and then use a big heavy forklift to pick it up and then move it onto a truck. I don't know if you can picture this, but the crate is about 123 inches long, about 7 feet, almost 8 feet long, 81 inches tall. It just barely made it through the door of the building, so we were able to have that whole crate inside the building, so that's an advantage.
How wide?
53 inches wide, more than 4 feet wide. He had plenty of room in that crate, too. That's important. It's important that animals have enough room, but not too much room that they could turn around or turn over in.
Okay, so was he able to sit? How can he sit? Could he sit down, and did he sit down?
Yeah, he sat down a couple of times. More importantly, he could lay down when he's comfortable. When you're riding up in a plane, that motion will tend to often calm animals, and when it's in motion like that, they'll often lay down. And he laid down and go to sleep, and most often he was relatively calm. He was a bit anxious and active from, what was it, Anchorage to Hong Kong. I don't know if it was the way the plane was flying or the noise, because you're in a cargo plane and it's kind of loud, but he seemed a little bit anxious during that period of flight. But other than that, he was calm and quiet. He ate when we wanted him to eat. He didn't drink a whole lot, but we did get him to drink some, ate a lot of produce.
And he was, when he lays down in the crate, his feet, his paws or whatever are aimed in the front. Could he lay on his side, or was he laying more?
Not so much on his side, mostly sternal, but he could kind of tip over to one side and kind of lean against the side of the crate with his legs kind of kicked out a little bit, but not all the way over on his side. Normally a rhino will lay with his back feet underneath him and front feet mostly spread out in front of him. Sometimes they'll lay kind of with the front legs tucked up underneath them.
And then did you have a separate door to get waste out of there? And how did you manage to do that throughout the trip?
Well, we could have, but the good thing was he didn't defecate in that crate until we got to Jakarta. And I can tell you a little bit about that, which I was pretty confident he wouldn't. He did urinate some in a stream. Male Sumatran rhinos often will spray urine, and it's not like other rhinos spray right behind them. Sumatran rhinos can spray upwards of 12 or 15 feet in the air.
Wow.
And I believe it's a way of marking their territory, communicating with other rhinos in the forest. He did not do that. He urinated a good long stream a couple of times. Sumatran rhino are very water driven, so that like when they walk through a stream or when he was in his pool, he would always defecate in his pool. So when we got to Jakarta and it was hot, it was 85, 90 degrees and it's very humid. People were concerned that he was going to be too hot, so they used water to kind of spray him from a spray dock, like a little hose with a water tank attached. And that's when he defecated in the crate. And I didn't even notice it. It probably had a bit of a smell to it. That was really the biggest time. And so we really didn't have to clean out his crate. He had wood shavings in there to soak up the urine, and he was to his destination within about 6 hours of landing. Yeah, the crates, there's a door in back that we slide closed, but there's also what people call butt bars, like a butt bar, but there's three of them that keep him off of that back door. So butt bars go in behind him, and that keeps him from going all the way to the back of the crate. So there's about a 6 inches. Had we needed to clean him out or do anything, we could have opened that back door and scoop everything out into bags, but we didn't even have to.
Wow. No, that's a good, and I was curious about all that and how, and so during the trip, you were right there next to him all the time.
95-98% of the time, yes.
And so it was either you,
Jack Nolman, who was a vet here in Cincinnati, great vet, very attentive to the animals. She was along with me, and they did catch me a couple times sleeping next to the crate, or at least getting a little bit of shut-eye. But yes, he was in a cargo plane, so we could go right there. Spent most of the time right there with him. He's a people rhino. He recognizes people. He comes when you call him. So having us there was reassuring to him, and I think helped to keep him a little bit calm. Animals obviously know that they're going somewhere when you lock them in there, and then they're outside a building, they're traveling in a truck. How intelligent they are, I don't know, but obviously they know something's happening. So I believe wholeheartedly that it was reassuring to him that somebody familiar was there with him.
And were you like petting him and stuff to try to calm him down when he was agitated? What do you do when he's agitated?
A little bit. You talk to him. You feed him produce. Food is kind of a calming effect. He loves his apples and bananas, and so we were. That's basically it. We were portioning out his browse, his food, that we took along for the trip, and I think we took half a box, I think 25 pounds of apples, 25 pounds of pears, same amount of bananas, and a whole bag of carrots, probably about 50 pounds of carrots. And he went through all that by the time we had just a little bit left in Jakarta, and on the truck ride from the airport to the ferry, he polished off the rest of his produce, but we still had browse there with him.
And was he, when you have him off of, you've got him, you're transporting him to the like you've arrived in Jakarta. I guess my last question on the plane, though, before that, just paint this picture for us. So you're sitting, when you're still on the plane, are you, for 50, or almost, I guess it's 40-something hours of aircraft time, right? It's like in the aircraft.
Yeah.
Okay, so that 47 hours, do you have a seat next to him? Picture, paint a picture for where the box is in the plane and where you guys are. Like, draw as if.
Okay, I'll paint it as clear as I can. We went on Cathay Pacific, C-A-T-H-A-Y.
Yep. I got
Pacific,
them.
Pacific, and they are cargo planes, and they take cargo of any kind anywhere. So upstairs, which I thought it was a huge plane, it's almost two stories, and we had seats upstairs directly behind the pilot, maybe 10 feet, 15 feet behind the pilot. So we had seats, but then you went through a door and you were required to be in your seat for takeoff and landing for safety reasons. But other than that, you could climb down a ladder, about a 10-foot ladder, and then he was right there at the bottom of the ladder, secured down on a cookie sheet, they call it. It's a big platform that they strap things down, and it locks securely into the floor of the plane. And there was a full cargo plane behind it of who knows what all, things flying to the Far East, boxes of this and crates of that, and we were directly above him, so you went down a ladder and he was right there, and our food and everything was strapped to the pallet that traveled with him, and we just go where he goes.
And so you hung out with him, you ate with him, you were basically by his side most, like you said, you were rarely at your seat, you would say, you were almost always, unless you were taking off or landing, were you basically by him?
Correct. Yes.
And the same with the vet.
Yes.
And when he gets there, you guys arrive at this venue. You've been there before. You were there for a remarkable experience. So you have some level of both familiarity and trust, I imagine. And so I guess my question would be: you're handing over someone who it's got to be tough, and we'll get to that as we close. But I mean, your confidence in these folks, your relationship with them. Can you talk about who is taking care of him, how much you know about them, and how safe he is going to be there?
Yeah. So we got there. There was a crane right there, ready and waiting to take him off the truck, put him in position. The keepers there are very focused, I think, is a good description. They spend as much time and they have as much invested in these rhinos as we do, and they take very good care of them. Maybe it's not exactly the same. You're outdoors all the time. They have a bit of a covering, and they call the rhinos up every morning and they hose them off. Very meticulous about what they feed. They record everything that they feed, what they do when they're up there, whether they defecate or how much water they drink. Sumati, who is the manager at the SRS, who I kind of bonded with the last time I was there, the last time he spoke very little English. He knows a little bit more now, but you have to really slow down. You have to really try to make them understand what you're trying to say, and they have to help me understand what they're trying to say. But when you're zookeeping, there's kind of an unwritten language, maybe, or body motions that conveys a lot. And and we talk, and we would exchange differences and talk about mud wallows. When you're taking care of Sumatran rhinos, mud wallows is a big deal.
I know.
These animals carve out and manage their own mud wallows in the wild. They visit every day, and that's a big part of keeping them happy. Like I said, water is a big conduit. I don't know what the right word is exactly. It's
a critical ingredient.
A critical ingredient. It's a motivator for eating and sleeping and all different kinds of things. I trust them absolutely. They are very focused in what they do. They understand that all the eggs are in one basket now, and they're very proud of the fact that these animals are in their country, and it's up to them to ensure their stability and their being on this planet for future generations to learn about.
Were there any, when you talk about that language barrier, were thinking about unloading him, you arrive, you're in a totally foreign country, yet you've been there before. Did you do the delivery of Andalus, actually?
I did not. I traveled with Andalus from Cincinnati to Los Angeles. He spent about 2 years there in Los Angeles, and then the Los Angeles Zoo, a good friend of mine, took him over there, and I heard all about it when they traveled with him. There's a lot of Sumatran rhino information out there. I could talk to you, it seems like, for days about these things. So I didn't travel with him, but I did travel with Andalus when he went to Los Angeles. And Harapan actually spent some time at White Oak Conservation Center in Florida, and we trucked him down there from Cincinnati. So I was pretty confident that Harapan was going to travel well. He traveled well the last time. And
so
delivering him over there, Terry Roth met us there. Widodo Ramono, who was like the director of the rhino counterparts in Sumatra, is a genuinely fantastic person. He's very focused on wildlife and rhinos, and he's just an incredible guy. And he speaks very slowly, and I speak slowly with him, and so that makes it a lot easier, having good people over there that want what's best for the animals and already know what they're doing, taking care of rhinos. There's some different facets to it, but all in all, they're taking care of them the way we would here.
And he went to the two final questions. What was the reason that he went, that Harapan went to L.A. and to the place in Florida? What was the reasoning, and how long was he in?
Mostly the reasons were we were expecting Emmy to breed again, and Emmy was pregnant when Andalus left here to go to Los Angeles. So that's what I was going to tell you. Because there's so many volumes and layers to the Sumatran rhino story. Emmy, when she came here to the U.S., lived in Los Angeles for about a year and a half. And we had Ipu, and there were different facets to the program. And instead of moving Ipu to Los Angeles, they agreed to bring Emmy here to Cincinnati. So technically, Emmy belonged, in quotation marks, to Los Angeles. So when Andalus was born,
the
natural thing was, in breeding agreements, like the first offspring will go to this place, and then the second offspring would stay here. He was destined to go to Los Angeles.
I get it.
And again, Harapan went to White Oak because we were expecting to breed again, and you needed more room, and they're very good with black rhino and white rhino and Indian rhino, and they were a logical place to move him. There was an agreement ahead of time. Well, not ahead of time, but there was a decision made to move him down there where he'd be probably best taken care of.
And you get there, I saw the video. It's a dramatic video when you open the box, and everyone's talking to him. It's heavy just to look at that video. I mean, you can tell the love for this animal that you guys have. And it is powerful to see him come out of his crate, knowing where, how long he's just spent in it, and to listen to all of you guys encouraging him and stuff. Was that a very heavy moment for you? Was there any emotional moments as you entered this final segment with him? Which, I mean, to me, I would be crying my eyes out if I had to say goodbye to him.
So it was, we were all hopeful, not hopeful, having him come out of the crate. Some people were concerned that he's, you know, his legs would be asleep and he would be a little bit wobbly. Honestly, I didn't. He moved so well in that crate. I would have thought there would be indications that he'd be weak or whatever, but he came out absolutely fine. In the moment, I thought the best thing for me to do was to go in there and get some food and make sure he knew where his water was. When I see it, I think, ooh, I shouldn't have done that. But it's what I'm drawn to do. It's I want to be close to those animals, those rhinos, and it just, for me, it seemed a logical thing to do. And to reassure him, again, he's come out of the crate, it's night, there's lights out there so people can and he can see, but still, again, it's obvious that he's in a new place. I'm sure the smells are new. He hears all these voices. For me, it was a way of reassuring him that everything's okay. He knows my voice. It was, that's why I did what I did.
And what did you do? You got in the thing. It's not on the video I saw. I just saw a short clip. He comes out of the box. It's about a minute long. It's a very, and that's all you know.
Yeah, there's and after that I went in and I got some browse from the outside and put it in, and he came up and started eating, and I was tapping the top of the water so that he knew where his water was and so that he could take a drink. I wasn't blubbering and crying emotional like that. I live in the moment, and it's about getting him out of that crate and getting him settled in. I knew we were going to be there for a few days, so I had time to say my goodbyes.
Talk about that.
I did the last thing. Somebody did send me a picture of it. I need to find it still, but I went up to him and I held his head and I told him to behave and to be good, and he'll have a good life here. And I know animals don't understand the English language, but it helps me to express that to him. And he is sorely missed, but I also know that he's in the best place he could be. Here, we didn't want him to leave. Not for a moment did we want him to go away and us be rhino-less at Wildlife Canyon, but you have to look at, he would have spent his whole life here by himself. Where he is now, he can breed. They'll start involving him in their breeding program. There's a certain female over there, Rosa, who has not conceived yet. It would be really nice because Sumatran rhinos can get aggressive and they can get dangerous for the rhinos, that it'd be nice if he was gentle, and if he could produce a calf over there, it would be just be out of this world.
And you, when you said your goodbyes, you were inside the enclosure with him, or we had a fence between you?
Yeah, right up with him. And he's, I don't know what it is about over there. Rhinos seem very good natured. They seem, almost seem to accept you as it's okay for you to be in there. You always have to be careful, and I was always extremely careful, but he was just kind of milling around. He had introduced to his mud wallow, and you could tell he was enjoying that. He got down in it, was carving down, and
what do you do? You
trying to kind of get that mud all over his back, and he was at ease. He was content laying in that mud wallow.
You just walk in there, though? Hey, you know, Hairpin, what do you do when you walk in? How do you call him? Because I know that they're supposedly, the eyesight isn't so good, so I know you want to, like, make sure he hears you or something.
Yeah, you do call him, and, you know, people say that their eyesight isn't good. It's not their best, it's not their most acute sense, but they can see just fine, and you call him, as long as he knows where you are and you're coming up to him, he was absolutely great. I try to keep her head up high so he doesn't already have his head down and getting ready to come after you, but it's just, you get used to things, and I'm used to it.
Wow. So you're there, you're in the environment, and you give him a big hug and a kiss, basically, and that's it. And you get to see him again?
I turned around and I left. I mean, it's emotional. I cry over the weirdest, oddest things, not so much as being separated, but it's hard coming back here to work, and you walk in the Rhino building down there, and it's quiet. Phew. It's all dry, and there's no animals in there anymore, and it's almost worse coming back here knowing that we have had Sumatran Rhino for 26 years and now we don't. We have to move on with something else. I've made it clear to everybody out there, if there's work to be done and jobs that they need done, and I'll be glad to step up and do them, but who knows what'll happen.
So you ever expect to see him again, Paul?
Yes, I do. Whether it's me going over there just to visit, or hopefully the job will come around that needs my signature on it, and maybe people will let me go over.
You're an expert on it, and I can imagine that he was very reassured to have you there. Paul Reinhart, Hairpin's keeper, team leader at the Wildlife Canyon Cincinnati Zoo. You've been there since 1981. You accompanied him on a historic trip. It really says a lot, the global sense of collaboration. People just doing right by this animal. It's just it's remarkable. So I'm really grateful for your time. I hope you know that.
It's my pleasure. If it helps even a little bit to spread the word and get people to know that these rhinos are out there and they need our help. You know, they don't even need our help. They didn't need us to leave them alone and let them do what rhinos do, stop cutting down their forest, stop poaching them. If it'll even do a little bit of good, I'll do it 1,000 times over.
I can tell. Yeah, I'd love any pictures, videos, anything. I'm a huge fan of this animal, and I mean, I cannot tell you how adorable he is. There are pictures of him. It's like, it moves me. I can't figure it out. You know, it's like, what's going on?
You're a rhino person, because not everybody has that reaction. But if you do have that reaction and you're called to it, you can honestly say that you're an animal man and a rhino man.
I just want to give him a big kiss right on his face. I mean, he is so adorable.
Go over there, get your higher-ups to send you over there and keep this story going. It can't be done now. It has to reverberate. There's been more talk about Sumatran rhino in the last month than there has in a whole long time, and the more that information gets out there and moves people, the better.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to do a piece, and I'm reaching out to a few folks, and I'm going to also try to involve the people at the Honolulu Zoo so I can give it a local perspective, because they have some rhinos here.
Yeah.
But I'll email you.
Black rhinos ended up in Hawaii many years ago.
What's that
I
now?
I remember his name. It was a black rhino.
Came from
one of our black rhinos born here ended up in Honolulu or in Hawaii somewhere, and I can't remember his name.
I'll figure it out. It's one of the ones here then, because they don't. I'm sure it's
probably. It was a male. I know it was a male.
That's so cool what you do. I'm giving you a huge hug, Paul, and you're a hero. Really, that you put your.
I appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
And I'll talk to you soon. Be safe, brother.
Okay, I'll email you. Thanks.
See you, Paul.
Bye.